Thanks for being here this afternoon, folks. The professor from Simon Fraser University asked me to say a few words of greetings, but we're Pacific Islanders too, from the Haida Islands. How does one greet another Pacific Islander? But welcome to Hawaii, all of you. I'll pretend to be a Hawaiian today. How are Delung Wadlawan off Kila Oslam? With an unslaska down.
Thank you also. Hada Lasi. Au Hatke Ajitlake Isis Dalung Wadlona Kilagan Hawa. I wanted to add my thank you to what Lawrence said to the people of this land who invited us here and from the University of Hawaii. Lawrence was also saying that it's been a while since he's traveled to Haida Gwaii, or since his people have traveled to Haida Gwaii. It's only been a couple of years, I think, but we also have kind of an intriguing story of some ancestors from a long, long time ago that actually traveled here, according to one of our stories. The place that we're talking about, many of you are familiar with it. This is the archipelago called Haida Gwaii, the homeland of the Haida people on the off the northwest coast of what is nowadays British Columbia. And we also have some Haida people that some centuries ago moved to the Alaskan Panhandle in Southeast Alaska. The two main communities nowadays are Massabit and Skidigit. It's a little bit dark, but you can see where the pin drops are. And the kind of long-term project that we want to tell you a little bit about today is our work with Hadas Gyatlungi, Haida stories. Gyatlungi are clan oral histories or oral traditions that are told by the Massabit Haida. And their oral histories are oral traditions that narrate events in the past lives of Haida people connected to specific ancestral villages and matrilineal clans. They're not situated in chronological time. For the most part, they reference events that took place at what we figure was before the first Yatzhade or European set foot to the islands. Some of them appear to be set somewhere in the 1800s, or some of them even more recently. And back in 1900, John Swanton spent a year in Haida Gwaii and actually very prolifically recorded with then Haida elders and speakers about 100 texts of varying lengths in the language, so they're in bilingual editions, and an equal number of Skidigit texts. Back in the, between the late 1970s and late 1980s, I, during my doctoral research, recorded Gyatlungi, some of whom Swanton had earlier recorded in different versions, some of them had never been told in any recording, from the late Emma Matthew Sundelne, who was born in 1894, and from Adam Bell, Chief Adam Bell Lana Stung, born in 1902, and they adopted me, and so I do them honor as storytellers, and for the incredible wealth of knowledge in their stories that they left us. For the last good number of years, I've worked together with Long Beast Scholar Lawrence, and also here and there with the late Koyang Claude Jones of Massabit. Claude, Chinny Claude, and Lawrence are, or respectively were, the last two male speakers of the language in Massabit. So it's, in terms of first language speakers, we're not in great shape, but we have great hope of young people. Some of you may have heard Lucy and Amelia's talk just a few minutes ago. And one of the important thing that we all face is to produce what we can call a critical mass of younger speakers of the language to bear the torch for the next generation. And the story work is some of this. So we've worked with this body of Gyatlinge clan stories, translating, transcribing them, and doing some linguistic analysis with them. But also beyond just that, understanding how those storytellers of the past deployed grammatical forms to poetically convey cultural meanings connected to land, sea, winds, directions, and cultural activities. But the other important task is retelling them to new generations of children, youth, and adults in Haida-Gwaii, and connecting a new generation of Haida people to the Gyatlinge of their ancestors. So I'll leave it with Kelly now, who is my PhD student, and she has joined the fold in the last year or so. As I've said to my colleagues and friends in Haida-Gwaii or at Simon Fraser many times, we need an army of transcribers, and we need all hands on deck. So it's always welcome to have somebody who helps in the arduous task of transcribing and making sense.
So as Marianne said, I'm her PhD student, and for one of my PhD qualifying papers, Marianne and Lawrence graciously allowed me to take a look at this one particular story that Marianne had recorded with Emma Matthews. And it's the story of Ichtini, and it tells of him. He's a chief at Kyusta. He gets blown out to sea while he's fishing. And there's a number of different interesting things in the story. One of the interesting things for me was that it really illustrates the connection that Marianne mentioned between culture, language, and place. And it also shows some characteristic linguistic and narrative features. So what I did was I started from the recording that Marianne had of Emma Matthews and began the task of transcribing it, both into the Haida Practical Orthography, which is the first line there, and then breaking it up into morphemic glossing, so breaking down each word into its various parts, seeing which word, which parts had meaning attached to them, and then glossing them. And the third line is just international phonetic alphabet to make it accessible to linguists as well. And you see the fourth line down, that gives you the breakdown of what each individual word means. So for example, in the second word there, you see the word tajue, which means wind. It has the definite ending there. Glossy means good, and that has the aerial marker there. And then the last line is just an English translation. And again, throughout this process, Marianne and Lawrence were indispensable. I wouldn't have been able to even begin the project without them. So just to give you an idea of what the story is about, I already mentioned that it's about Ichtini, who's a chief at Kyusta, and you'll see where that is if you don't already know on the map that's coming up. He's out fishing and he gets blown out to sea. Due to the pattern of the winds, which play a big part in the story, he's eventually blown all the way up to the Stikine or Tlingit country. A child finds him. In this version of the story, it's a little girl who finds him. The Tlingit nurse him back to health, and he stays with them for some considerable length of time. And once he's healed and the weather has improved, the Tlingit escort him partway back, and then he returns to his family and chiefship at Kyusta. And the name Ichtini continues to be a chiefly name among the Coas Eagles. And I actually think there's a picture of the Prince William and the Duchess of, she's the Duchess of Cambridge. I think they actually met the current Ichtini when they visited up in Haida-Gwaii a bit ago. And this is just a picture here of what it might have looked like up at Kyusta when Ichtini was getting blown around by the winds. So you'll see here, Ichthini starts here off the shore of Kyusta. And one thing that's important here, going back to this idea of cultural information, he would have been an adept fisherman. So you have the winds that come up from the southeast, blow him out to the ocean, then they shift to ones from the southwest, which results in him getting blown all the way up to Tlingit country. Another interesting thing, and I'll go through this kind of quickly, there's a lot of semantically complex verbs. So Haida packs a lot of information into the verbs. You can see just a couple examples here, and you can look at them later after the presentation so that Marianne can talk. It has all of these different parts contributing to the meaning. And then we have also a kind of a more narrative feature where you have this sequence of suffixes with S plus a long E, which is something that seems to be characteristic of narrative. And it's the complementizer plus a topic marker down in the second example here, and it serves to zoom in on whatever the topic of the sentence is. So that's what I looked at from my work on this story, and I'll let Marianne continue.
And what Lawrence and I have continued to do, which are nearly finished now, is the analysis and glossing transcription work of these 15 very intricate stories. And one particular set among those, it's like a four-story cycle that takes place on the west coast of Graham Island in Haida Gwaii at a village called Tian, where two boys disrespectfully kill buffleheads. That's these little ducks here, if you don't know them. They're known as the grandchildren of killer whales. And so that's why humans, killer whales, who are the embodied souls of drowned people, and buffleheads have a connection. And they then get transformed. And then the second story in the cycle is a woman who has an illicit affair with a devilfish, causing her husband and his clan group to move in embarrassment to Yaku, on the north coast of Graham Island, nearby Kyusta. And the subsequent move to Yaku, where the clan's people receive help from killer whales, who procure cedar poles from them from quite a faraway place and actually carry them to the village for them and then get potlatched. And while fishing near Yaku and Kyusta, four men from the clan that had moved go fishing again and get blown all the way out to Hawaii, and eventually make it back with the help of navigating with the North Star, with terns or seagulls, and with currents, and again receiving help from killer whales. So it is a whole cycle of very interesting stories. And this here is the village of Tian. It's hard to see here, that's where the pin drop is on the left. That's where it's situated. One of the things we also got out of the Gyatme from Lana Stung, Adam Bell, was quite an intricate set of place names that and sea names that refer to reefs, to supernatural places, and so forth, and landmarkers. Let's skip over this. There's not much left of the village of Tian nowadays. We took a pilgrimage with a few of us that have been working on place names and stories to the village a couple of summers ago. It's overgrown now, even the totem poles are down and overgrown. But lessons from Tian, as they came out of these oral histories, there was one very interesting thing. I don't know if any of you have worked with or read any of John Swanton's stories from 1900. The Swanton recordings were made with elders who dictated very painstakingly stories in Hatkil in the language to him, and Swanton then wrote them down. And so they're, it's one sentence, something happened, period. Then something happened, period. Then something else happens, period. The stories as recorded in audio from these storytellers from the late 1800s, early 1900s, are quite different in terms of the narrative conventions and the linguistic conventions. They include much longer sentences with many embedded relative subordinated clauses, which if we take only the Swanton stories as the kind of benchmarks for narrative, we get a very limited perspective on how Haida storytelling actually works. And I've mentioned place names. There are intricate sets of directionals. Haida has two main prepositional phrases. So there's no north, south, east, west, because it doesn't make sense on Haida Gwaii. There is an out to sea and an out back towards the woods direction. And from any given point in Haida Gwaii, you can basically orient yourself as to where you are. And the stories, including the Ildini story, make much use of that. There's quite an inventory of what we call derivational directional suffixes, words for going across something, under something, over something, through something, and so on and so forth. And because Haida is a polysynthetic language, they're basically embedded in the verb stem to then give very subtle meanings that often relate to travel and movement on the land or sea that are sometimes difficult to translate. And we also got some semantic things out of it. And I'm just using that this is one example here. In the Devilfish story, her brother observes the woman carrying on with the devilfish. And he, at the same time, the only reason he's there is because he has himself an illicit affair with a clansmate. So it's not a black and white story. It's full of nuances. And the storyteller, in him telling about the young man reporting about seeing his sister, only says he saw her behavior through to the end. So we don't get the kind of, if you want, graphic detail or something, but the sentence kind of says everything about that he was present and leaves it up to the imagination. We also have fascinating tsunami descriptions, especially in the Devil's Fish story from Tian, because the consequence of what happened is the tsunami hits the village. And so you have numerous narrative parts there where he watches the big waves. It's as they couldn't tell if it was high tide or low tide. Everything was mixed up. And so for the 2 minutes?
2.5 minutes.
Yeah. So for the final part, it's hard to see with the light on, I guess, but so what we've done in the last few years is taken or workshopped the stories with the learners in Masset to both bring them back and to practice what are sometimes very detailed and complex narrative forms, vocabularies, grammar pieces. And so these are the intermediate and beyond learners in Masset, who then also practiced actually bringing them back to life by telling them again. But the most important thing, I think, is teaching them out on the land. For a number of years now, I've been asked by Chief Matthews School in Old Masset to be the Haida language teacher and storyteller that kind of, in a way, puts me as interlocutor of Lana Stung's and Sandrine's stories with the permission and support of the elders. Because the elders can't go to these cultural camps. Sometimes we manage to get a helicopter and can fly somebody right to the spot, but it's a several-hour boat ride, and then it's a hour or more hike up and down tree trunks and so forth. So going out there with the kids is one way then to retell them. And we take them to places. This is Yak, or the beach in front of Yak, where the killer whales, in one of the stories in the cycle, hauled big cedar trees that became the house posts up on the beach. And they then, the people from Yak feasted the killer whales with fresh water as a sign of grace. And to bring it full circle, the children from Chief Matthews includes a graduate here, Amelia
right? Who I think you've met when several times, right, with the group. They are at that age between 6 and 11, and they take absolute joy in hearing these stories and hearing them told on the land. And Emma Matthews, Sandelne herself, who told the Ildini story, said the way she heard this was when my mother was married to Juan's father, and while we were staying at Naden Harbor, this story in the evenings over and over, together with old things, stories about the olden days, he used to tell us. She says, I will never forget it. When you're at that age and you hear something, you will never forget it. Forget it. That is how I am. That's right. And that's it.
We have about 9 minutes for questions.
Yeah.
Just curious, how are the young people, are they speaking the language more as a result of these efforts and the storytelling? What is the outcome of this incredible effort?
Well, it's a couple of things. Chief Matthews has a, I think, what is a strong language program. It's not an immersion program, but the children, for one thing, get a good dose of the language in their daily lessons. Secondly, because of where they are, it's not just the big field trip every 2 years, but also they're able to go out on the land, on the beach, harvest seafood and go to fishing camp and all that. And the language is fully integrated into that, and we've built many lessons where they then learn the sentences and vocabulary for that. I think the connection, it's both about the language, as you know, learning the language, becoming fluent or proficient in it, but also the connection with place and story. And they might not be able to fully yet retell a story the way they hear it in a, you know, one of these very complex versions. But it's interesting when I meet the kids again later, they remember them. And I think that's really important, that it, at that age, connects them. Mm-hmm.
Are you using the stories for curriculum development? You have a really interesting one about the Hawaiian Islands.
Yeah.
So we're using our stories as ways to track El Nino and wind patterns.
Yeah, we've done some of that with Claude Jones and who we mentioned earlier, and another now deceased elder, Stephen Brown, building lessons around winds and tides and all these natural phenomena. Moons are, of course, the moon is important around how it shapes tides. So, yeah. And science lessons. Yeah?
The stories that you recorded as compared to the ones that have been transcribed a long time ago, were they recorded, was the person just talking to the tape recorder, or was it to an audience? Or what was the context?
No, for one thing, this was 1900, so they were not audio recorded, not even on wax cylinder.
Well, I mean recently, though.
The ones that I recorded, so they were audio recorded, and we've digitized them. They were, some of them were, like with Lawrence and Adam Bell's wife present, so it was a small audience. Some of them were just the storyteller and myself. Well, we've, over the last number of years, held Haida language classes, just different kind of avenues for people individually, in groups or in small groups, learning and relearning the language. And as we've been transcribing stories and analyzing them and getting familiar with them, then Lawrence and I have brought them back to the community by way of workshopping them. And some of them we've integrated into curriculum for the local schools.
And animation. Animation, too.
And, that's right. The Hot Kitkusu Society produced some very interesting animated short films. They're on the Haida Council of Haida Nation website, right? Yeah, so that's been another way to get them out. Okay.
We still have time. Okay. Okay, so thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.